Hi, everyone.
Whoa.
Did you get that?
My name's Matt McGain. I work for SitePoint. We're a Melbourne-based publisher of books for web designers and web developers. And we're running a competition. You might have seen in the conference bag there's a notepad telling you how you can win an iPod Touch. All you need to do is tell us why you love the web, and you could score yourself a very cool iPod Touch. We're also hiring at SitePoint, so come up and chat to one of us in the orange and blue if you think that's something that sounds interesting. Okay, on to our next speaker. Andy Clark is a well-respected designer, author, blogger, and educator based in the UK. He runs his own consultancy, Stuff and Nonsense. He's a member of the Web Standards Project, and he's an invited expert to the W3C's CSS Working Group. He's the author of an excellent book called Transcending CSS, and he's also famous as the guy who failed his motorcycle driving test for putting his foot down during a U-turn. He's here today to deliver a talk entitled Think Like a Mountain. He also has a very exciting announcement to make at the end of the talk, so pay attention. Please make him welcome, Andy Clark.
Good morning. This is where I expose the inner workings of my Mac. Here we go. Much better. Thank you so very much for coming. It's wonderful to be back in Sydney again. It's one of my favourite places in the world. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about CSS. I've got something that I want to talk about at the very end of the presentation. But as is my want today, I'd like to steer the conversation away a little bit from technical aspects of web development and talk more about design. And I'm one of those people that, you know, I'm sure that everybody's the same. You know, we don't live in a kind of a web vacuum. And there are lots and lots of other influences that play a part in the work that we do, whether we're designers or we're developers. And one of the things that I've been passionate about for a very long time is comic books. And I think that whether or not you are a creative person or a technical person, there's always something to find in comics that I think can be very beneficial when we start to look at them and get the brain juice going and think about how we can maybe apply some of the conventions and the design principles and some of the creative inspiration from comic books and see whether or not we can bring that into the work that we do for the web. So that's what I'm going to do today. Just quick straw poll of hands. How many people here are visual designers, would you say? Oh, fair few. And who works with code? Who's more of a developer? Oh, so kind of a maybe 60-40 split. Who in the audience reads comics on a regular basis? Oh, not that many. Not that many. This is interesting because I don't know whether it's true here, but certainly when I was growing up, comics were a medium that were kind of looked down on a little bit. It was always seen as an ill-refined or perhaps an immature thing to do, to read comic books. And you know, that was something that I never thought. But it's certainly a perception, I think, that's grown up in the, or for a time grew up in the wider world. But comics themselves have had a tremendous influence, not just on movies, as we've seen perhaps over the last few years, but also on the fine arts. If we think about artists like Robert Rauschenberg or Roy Lichtenstein, who really looked at comic artwork and thought about ways in which they would bring elements of comic books into their artwork. I think the most obvious thing over recent years has been raiding of the comic book archives in terms of the movie industry. Has anybody here not seen a comic-inspired movie over the last few years? I can't imagine there's many. And comics have always provided this wonderfully rich library of ideas and stories. And the movie industry in particular has looked on comics as a very rich resource, and sometimes they've done it very badly, if anybody's seen The Hulk. Sometimes they've done it rather well. I mean, the first Spider-Man movies were particularly good. I don't think we're going to talk about Superman 4, The Quest for Peace this morning. Best forgotten. But one of the movies which has been really, really of interest to me over the last couple of years has been Sin City. Who's seen the movie? Yeah. Okay, so who's read the book as well? Okay, so smaller percentage. Who are the total nerds who have seen the movie and read the book at the same time? Gary Barber and a couple of others. Well, Sin City is an interesting one because Frank Miller, who was the writer and artist behind Sin City, was always passionate that his books were never going to get made into movies. And the backstory behind Sin City was very interesting. And it was really only because of the work of Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino to a certain degree that actually persuaded Miller to allow Sin City to be made. And the extras on the DVD, if you get them, are incredibly interesting. I mean, Sin City is just unbelievable. I mean, not only is it a great piece of work in its own right, but if you think about where the influences that went into Miller's working of it, if we think about hard-boiled fiction, detective stories, and film noir, there's an amazing amount of detail and influence that's gone into this story. And the panels themselves are just incredibly, incredibly cinematic. So just as the comics themselves were inspired by hard-boiled fiction and film noir, the movie itself takes a very different approach to a lot of comic book adaptations when it comes to actually putting the movie together. So this is a small snippet of one of my favorite scenes. I need some audio on this. No? Okay, let's wind this back. Okay. If we can have audio on the stage, that'd be great.
You're never talking. I don't know about you, but I'm having a ball.
If you haven't read the book and seen the movie at the same time, then go back and do it, because there is almost a frame-by-frame comparison that you can do. Utterly beautiful.
So I'll just fill you in on the latest batch. These here hands of mine, they got blood all over them.
You're speaking figuratively.
I need to find something out. I just go out and look for somebody that knows more than me, and I go and I ask them. Sometimes I ask pretty hard. By way of, for instance, I killed 3 men tonight. Torture first. You might say I've been working my way up the food chain. First 2 were minnows, small-time messengers. But it was Connolly, the money man who fingered you, Padre.
Dear Lord, man, this is a house of God.
Just give me a damn name.
Rourke. You really are pushing your luck, Padre, feeding me garbage like that. Can't be that big.
There's a farm out North Cross in Lenox. It's all there. Find out for yourself. While you're at it, ask yourself if that corpse of a slut is worth dying for.
Worth dying for? Worth killing for? Worth going to hell for? Amen.
So if you watch the movie at the same time as reading the comic books, one of the things that you're going to realize is that it's the way that the movie's been put together, it's much more of an extension of the comic books, an interpretation of the comic books, rather than what we normally see in comic book-inspired movies like Spider-Man, which is an adaptation. So comics have had an incredible influence not only on art, the fine arts, and particularly on commercial mediums like movies. But they've also had, I think, an influence on a lot of small boys who sit in their bedrooms reading comics who later go on to become geeks. And those geeks build websites. So I wonder whether we can take it one stage further and actually think about whether or not there are things that we can take out of comic books, comic book artwork in particular, and the way that we actually read and understand and follow the story of a comic book, and apply those to the web. Now, one of the things that is interesting about the way that comic books are put together is that every writer and artist combination will have a particular style, whether it's a particular art style, whether it's a particular writing style, or even just the way that the panels themselves on the pages are put together. So in the same way that when a visitor comes to a website, they have to learn very quickly how to use that site, with a comic book, you have to learn very quickly how to follow the story from panel to panel. So there are some similarities there. And there's a very good book that I would recommend that you pick up, which is Understanding Comics by a guy called Scott McCloud. And he spends a lot of time going into the theory and the working science, if you like, behind the way that comic books are put together. And one of the things that he talks about a lot is what he calls closure. And closure is an interesting concept, because when we're laying out panels of content on the website, we're really thinking about just the content that goes inside those panels. What's interesting in a comic book is actually what goes on between the panels. And this is what McCloud calls closure. Now, I like to think of it in much more of a kind of a Photoshop-y way, and I like to think of it in terms of interpolation. Because what happens when you read a comic, unlike a movie where you have a frame-by-frame timescale, with a comic book, you only have a limited amount of space and a limited amount of opportunities to be able to get a reader to understand what's going on within that space. So what happens between the panels, that's where the brain starts to work, and the brain starts to make decisions to fill in the gaps, to interpolate the pixels, if you like, between the panel. And the gaps between the panels and the way that they're used, which is actually just as interesting as what goes on inside the panels themselves. And there are various different types of interpolation or closure that you see within a book. So the first one here is what we would term movement-to-movement interpolation. So this is like the zoom out in a movie. And your brain can really easily put the pieces together. It needs very, very little processing power to interpolate the space between the panels. Much more of a linear progression. But if we look at something like this, this is something like a cause and effect or an action to action panel, where there are gaps where the guy hands the newspaper. But what happens here, what happens between the second and third panels, is the character is then reading the front cover of that newspaper. But that's implicit. It's not there presented graphically on the panel. But it leaves our mind to imagine what goes on. We might also have subject-to-subject interpolation. So all of this action is going on within the same scene. But again, we're not told in a frame-by-frame, 32 frames per second way exactly what's happening. Our mind is left to fill in the gaps. And this creates a certain amount of drama because we don't go on. We're not seeing everything all at once. And then, of course, what we have is scene-to-scene cuts. And this is where it becomes a little bit more interesting when we start to think about relating this back to the web. Because particularly in this book here, which is The Watchmen by Alan Moore, which is another favorite book of mine, there are a lot of scene-to-scene cuts. And this really does require the reader to have a lot more deductive reasoning to figure out exactly what goes on. These are the same character, but just going back in time. And The Watchmen is a wonderful layered story with lots of different time frames going on all at the same time. So our brain is having to join the gaps and wonder and figure out what goes on between the panels. And if we relate that back to the web, that's very much, in my mind, like clicking between one web page or another. We imagine, perhaps, what we're going to get when we click a link. But when we actually arrive at the destination, is it what we expect? Do we have to then re-understand how to then learn or use the page that we end up on? So there are similarities, I feel, very much between the way that we get a visitor to actually understand the movement and the flow across a website and the way that a comic book artist creates the movement and uses the spaces, the white space between the panels, to tell much more of the story. Now, Watchmen's a wonderful book. It's never been made into a movie yet. I wonder whether or not they could actually do it. But has anybody read Watchmen? Yeah, a few hardcore comic geeks. Because when we start to think about the actual panels of content, when we start to design content panels for a web page, often what we're doing is we're sometimes predefining a template. Has anybody done that? Where you actually define a series of templates for a particular site, but then the content comes in and we're actually just filling in the blanks. The other thing that we often do is to change the size of the panel relative to the amount of content, perhaps, that goes in it. And we're thinking about things in maybe a slightly different way. Watchmen, this is a double-page spread. Watchmen uses a wonderful symmetry technique. So every one of the panels, every one of the pages, is this symmetrical 9x9 grid. And this is notable, really, because as you move through the story, this 9x9 grid, or 3x3 grid, is maintained all the way through 12 issues of the book. And there's often a lot of symmetry that goes on, not just between what goes into the panels, but obviously also because of the entire shape. So it's very interesting when you start to see the way that these panels are laid out, and there's a rhythm that's created as you move throughout the book. Interestingly, the way that the symmetry works is that it mirrors relationships not only between different characters, but also between the same character at different points in time. And the only time that Dave Gibbons, the artist, breaks out of this 3x3 nine-panel grid is for particular dramatic effect. He's not breaking out of that grid because there's more content to go into a particular panel. He's breaking out of that grid to provide real dramatic effect. And the decision over how many panels are used is often not to do with the amount of content that goes into a particular panel. It's much more to do with the rhythm of the design and the timing that takes a reader through the story. So let's have a look at timing. Let's think about how we actually lay out pages on the web and how the size and shape of the panels in comic books can maybe change the way that we think about laying out web pages. The interesting thing about comic book art is that the size of the panel itself is not only there to decided by the amount of content that goes in it, but also the time that a reader takes to actually looking at a particular panel. So a reader is going to take a lot more time looking at a panel like this than they are going to do with a smaller one. And the size of the panel changes the amount of time. But it also, as we see in Watchmen, emphasizes major parts of the story. Now, the other interesting thing is that a panel can contain more than one point in time, particularly when it's a large linear spread. So unlike a movie where we see everything literally in a linear order, we can see within a large panel that there can be several different time zones, several different time panels, working their way through each large block. So when we take a small panel like this, we spend less time looking at that. And multiple small panels create a rhythm. It's a very much of a musical process to look at the design of a page. So this is another one of my favorite books. This is Concrete by an artist called Paul Chadwick. Now, he hasn't written anything now since about, I think it's 98 was the last time that there was any comic published. But this is one of my absolute favorites. It's a very strange character, very strange and subtle story. But as you work your way through each of the panels, you can see that Chadwick uses the size and the shape of the panels themselves, not only to emphasize the amount of time that you're supposed to be looking at each one, but to provide a sense of drama as we move through. So if we break that down into some grey box layouts and think about how we might work this through to the web, we can see that there are lots of different simplified blocks, each one providing an even or an uneven amount of time to look at those panels. So, there's a specific rhythm, there's a specific movement as we move from page to page, and also within a page. And I wonder sometimes whether or not it's possible to use that rhythm when we do web design in order to tell the story of whatever it is that we're actually trying to convey the meaning of to our audiences. So whether or not it's, say, an e-commerce store, for example, where we're trying to provide emphasis on a particular product or a particular, let's say, special offer, using the size and shape of those panels to draw the user's attention and give them more room and more time to assimilate that content. Now, it's interesting. If we look at some of these panels, you see the one on the middle top left there. Why do some of these panels have borders and some of them not? Why does some of the artwork bleed all the way to the edge of the page rather than being confined by a border? Well, it's interesting. This is a common technique which goes on amongst comic design. So if we look at something like this, we can see that when the content in this center panel isn't confined by a bounding box, it takes our eye a lot longer to move across that panel because our eye can go all the way to the edges of the page. So if we compare this to what we do a lot of the time in web design, which is a fixed kind of 770 layout in the middle of the page, and compare that to this, we can see that much more emphasis is given to the panel that doesn't have a border, which is actually the complete opposite of what we would think of when we do web stuff. We think about the fact if we want to draw emphasis to something, we're going to put a great big box around it, and that's what's going to draw people's attention. But it's the complete opposite in this case. So there's lots of different techniques that perhaps we can use, perhaps we can port over from comic design to help our visitors work their way through the content. So sometimes we might use borders. And this was a technique which was really popularized by a guy called Will Eisner way back in the 1930s and 40s, who used a lot of alternating content blocks, some of them open, some of them bound, to create this wonderful kind of natural rhythm that runs down the pages. So sometimes it can use borders. Sometimes we might use alternating background images. Now, we think of this in terms of zebra striping tables a lot of the time, but let's perhaps think about it in terms of not only drawing emphasis to particular products or particular areas of content, but also the amount of time, perhaps, that we want somebody to spend actually looking at a particular piece. And we might do a similar thing just by adjusting the contrast very, very slightly. Because the optical grey of the darker text is going to draw our eye specifically to those panels. And again, there's this musical quality that runs all the way through. And I think one of the interesting things about comics is that because they are all so different, they have to use devices which enable their readers to very easily understand and to move through the story. And that's something perhaps that we can learn from. And there are various different techniques that comic book artists use which really help the user understand the story, even when they're very new to a book. And one of those, believe it or not, is actually splash pages. So, who uses splash pages these days? Anybody put a nice big fat flash movie on the page with a skip intro link? Because that's often what we think about when we think about splash pages. But I think we need to have another look at what we might term splash pages and realise that they shouldn't be confused, perhaps, with the cover art that we perhaps thought that splash pages were. The old school splash pages were really there. I mean, how many times have you had a client that says, you know, I want to make a big impression the first time somebody visits a site, and that's why we have splash pages on the web? Well, you know, in comic book art, splash pages are important, but they shouldn't be confused with covers, because covers do a particular job. If you walk into a comic store, are there any decent comic stores in Sydney? There are a few. The job of the cover is to draw your eye to a particular title. And when there's millions of comic book titles out there, just like there are millions of web pages out there, the artist here is really his job is to make you want to pick up that book and see what's inside it. But we shouldn't confuse comic art with splash pages, cover art with splash pages. Yet on the web, there isn't any real need to make that first impression because somebody's hit your URL. The other reason why cover art is interesting is that it provides continuation across a series of books. So again, if we go back through to Concrete, Chadwick's not only a great panel artist, he's one of these rare comic book artists who's excellent at covers, but also excellent at actually storytelling as well. There are very few people that can do that. But the continuation across the series, again, helps the rhythm. It helps the reader understand that they are in a particular place. And that's something perhaps that we ought to think about when we're designing pages, because we shouldn't necessarily think of these pages simply as home pages. If you imagine somebody coming into a site and looking at a particular section of products or content, main content area, we want to try to help the reader to understand exactly where they are. So these things are like establishing shots. So if we move into the first panel, this is really where we start talking about splash pages in detail. And their job really is to establish the reader's focus, is to give them a sense of place within the book and to make them realize that they're actually starting out on a journey. And as I say, they're not simply for home pages if we convert this to the web. They can also contain very useful and active information. And I think it's going to be interesting if we think about ways in which we can use these type of panels to give people much more of a sense of place. Now, one of the interesting things, particularly if I pull up this panel here, is that we have got For the New Reader. And this is a technique that Chadwick uses a lot, and he's not alone in this. But this For the New Reader content is actually quite interesting, because how many times do you try to set the scene for a person that's absolutely brand new to the site? Not everybody starts a comic book with issue one, and certainly not all web users come in through the homepage. So thinking about ways in which we can, again, help the reader to understand where they are, give them helps and tips, and again, perhaps on the web we allow them to dismiss that kind of content once they've used it. So they can be incredibly interesting. And certainly when we can combine that kind of visual impression with useful information and useful tools, I have this concept that I call active branding. How often do you see a web page, particularly on blogs, where you have a very large image across the top of the page? Andy Budd with his picture of Brighton Pier, perhaps, which really actually doesn't do anything except add a little visual, you know, visual identity. Maybe we should try to be thinking about ways in which we could combine that big impression with active content to allow a reader to really understand exactly where they are. And that's one of the most important things when it comes to comic book art and also to web design, is to help the reader flow through the content, through the page, and through the site. And quite often we leave visitors up to their own devices. And we imagine, perhaps because we think that the sites that we make are very easy to use, we imagine that this flow is like water, and the visitor just kind of naturally bobs along from page to page and link to link. Unfortunately, I don't think that's often the case, because what people tend to do is they tend to stab at things. So they'll poke at a link, and then if it's no good, they'll hit the back button and try something else. And really what we want to do, I think, is to help our users to navigate through the story that we're trying to tell them. And there are various different ways in which comics do this, not only from page to page, but more interestingly, on the panels that actually are on the page themselves. So if we take something like this, which is a panel from Concrete, there's a lot of similarity often there, isn't it, with the grid design that we're trying to achieve on the web. So how does somebody move across this page? Well, in Western-speaking cultures, we obviously read from left to right. So the object of our game is to move from the top left-hand corner to the bottom right-hand corner. And on something like this, our brain doesn't require too much processing power to make this work. We can easily go across and down and then up again and end up down in that bottom right-hand corner. But what happens when we have something like this? Does that remind you of like a typical three-column layout for the web? Where do we go? We might start off there, and it's natural to move across to the right. But what happens when we get here? Do we go down? Or do we move across into this space? How do we end up? Our brain all of a sudden is confused. It's starting to wonder exactly which order we should be reading that content. Now, comics have certain techniques that they use a lot in order to create a flow, an eye flow, across a page. So if we take another panel from Concrete, this is breaking away from that traditional layout. It makes it even more difficult, perhaps, to read the content in the right order. So one of the techniques that comic book artists use is the position of speech balloons. And again, these are not just there to provide containers for text. They're there to provide timing and rhythm, and also to allow a reader's eye to flow naturally across a page. So let's go back to a regular page layout and start thinking about ways in which we can actually help our readers to do this. Well, the first thing that we can do, as we've seen before, is we can use contrast. So here, just by providing text in a darker color, we can help the user to move from one place to the other very, very easily. And even if we change the actual order of the content, the eye flow is still the same. Or we might use images. Now, images are usually or often added arbitrarily. I mean, there's plenty of times when the client says, oh, we must have a picture of our product here. Maybe not necessarily to illustrate the point, but just because they actually want that image there. And our eyes are naturally drawn to images much more than they're drawn to text, particularly when those images contain faces, because it's the first thing that you look at is somebody's eyes. So just by a clever use of those images, we've provided a very easy flow, even though the contrast of the text is all the same. And if we change the order, we don't make it any more difficult. Now, we haven't always got relevant images together, but let's think about headings. Quite often you get a whole raft of text from a client without headings at all. I mean, if you've ever had like 3,000 words in Word provided, as I have, trying to make some kind of structure out of that. But quite often the headings themselves are positioned arbitrarily. They're there because sometimes they may sit on top of relevant content, but we can use headings as a way of being able to draw a reader's eye across a page. So on this particular case, we're able to draw the reader's eye right down to this Buy Now button, which may be the most important task that we want them to perform. And a combination of all three. Now, this timing is really, really important for comic books, and it's also really important for the web as well, because we do want to be telling stories. We do want to be adding a sense of drama. And one of the books that I love most of all is this book, The Watchmen. And it was very interesting that throughout 11 months of this particular book, almost without exception, the 3 by 3 nine-panel grid was maintained. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of panels until we get to episode 11, so out of 12. And all of a sudden, in the last four pages, we start to see larger panels, and the pace of the story slows down as those larger panels are brought in. And then in the last spread of episode 11, we just have these three big panels, and the story slows way down. And then all of a sudden, it speeds up. We've got this action which goes on inside these smaller panels. And then nothing. Just a big panel of white space at the very end. And it was like, oh my God. I've got to wait another month for this thing to come out. I worked in a comic shop at the time. My friend Pete and I were just like, oh. And then a month later, when the shipment arrived, you know, this was the first thing that we kind of ripped out of the box, and this was the cover. And we opened it up, and the first six panels, no dialogue, just these incredible, beautifully detailed, but really kind of stunning establishing shots before we got into the conclusion of the story. So why do we not try to create this sense of drama, perhaps, when we're producing content and designs for the web? Well, maybe some people do. If you saw Apple.com when the iPhone was released, there it was. It was just, welcome to iPhone. So maybe there are some people out there that do this. But this sense of drama, to me, is incredibly important, because at the end of the day, whether we're providing content for people to read, or we're trying to get them to achieve a task, we want to perhaps add a sense of pace and a sense of, you know, sense of drama. We don't want pages to crash and that be the drama. But it is useful to provide this pace so that people can actually get a sense of movement as they move from place to place. So drama is incredibly important. Now, going back to kind of some movie adaptations, we can see throughout this next session, which is Aliens, again from Dark Horse, the way in which their artwork was taking its lead from the first movie, but giving it a distinctive style. And quite often when we create boxy designs for the web, those are kind of, I don't know, standard stuff. There's no real reason why we can't take aspects of the brand and bring those branding concepts into the use and size and shape of the panels. So this is wonderful stuff. Again, the way that the speech balloons and the dialogue help lead your eye around the page. And then we get to a panel like this. Something very, very subtle in the way that those two panels in the center at the top are offset at an angle. And just that minor amount of rotation gives the reader this real sense that something's wrong. There's this real disjointed feel. So again, when we start putting our content together or displaying our content on the page, just providing these little visual clues that something is different can really help bring the viewer into the story and set this particular area of content aside from what else is going on. And you can see similar things as we move through a few more examples. This is The Dark Knight Returns, which is another Frank Miller story, which, again, kicked off, gave new life to the Batman franchise. starts off with a 50-year-old Batman and ends with this cataclysmic battle between Batman and Superman. But again, just the way that these linear panels provide this movement, and hopefully we can start to think about ways in which we can bring this dynamism back into page layout design. Now, different artists have different interpretations of how panels are laid out. This is Grendel, which is another long-running story. It's a very odd type of story to try to follow. But various different artists across the last few years have been working on this. And as the books evolve, so the panel work becomes very, very challenging for the reader as you get further on into the stories. So we start off with something which is a little bit perhaps more conventional. And then the artists start to get really, really playful. And they start to break out of the comic conventions and start to use devices which sometimes, I have to be honest, make the things very, very difficult to read. But maybe that's okay in certain situations. It's this playfulness, it's this change of style that makes this thing so distinctive. And even when we do go back into grid-based layout, we can see that the emphasis that's being given to the particular character that sits on the right-hand side. If we just close our eyes for a minute and think about that in terms of 15 different products on a page, bringing the user's attention to just one particular one that we really want to emphasize. And doing the same thing in panels like this. Having most of the content inside these vertical stripes, but allowing things to break out. And when you start to actually break these things down, you can see that there's some very useful layouts that we might be able to play with and adopt. And the same thing happens with color as well. Color's always been interesting, not only on the web. I mean, anybody ever still care about web-safe colors these days? I don't even think I've thought about it for a very long time. But it used to be incredibly important in comic book printing. Because as a cheap medium for the masses, the paper quality was terrible in the early days. And therefore, strong colors, strong, defined, dynamic colors of ink were really not possible on the paper qualities that they had at the time. And things have changed over time. We're going to have a look at that. But if we compare comics that don't have color to comics that do, Concrete's work, to me, is much more dynamic and much more interesting in black and white than it ever is when it starts to become colored. And I think sometimes it's very important, certainly for me as a designer, to work on structure and page layout always in black and white before I start thinking about the colors and the shading that we're going to be using actually in the final result. Because when they do start to introduce color into Concrete and into lots of other comics as well, the color itself, to me, can dilute the message. It doesn't always add something. And quite often, clients are going to be the ones that are saying, oh, we need more color. We need this to really stand out. And perhaps just the subtle use of color, if you think about Sin City in the way that it's mostly monochrome, except those splashes of yellow and red, it's those splashes that are important, not the overall wash of color. And when they did start to introduce more dynamic color onto the web, on cheap paper qualities, this is the shadow, it didn't work. It became gaudy. It became unreal. And it really detracted away from the main message. Now, as comics became more mainstream and we had more movie tie-ins and perhaps there was a little bit more of a serious consideration of them, then better paper stocks were used, better printing techniques were used. And we can see that the artists themselves adapted to working in a slightly different medium. And again, this resonates for me very much on the web. Because when we start getting into the graphic novel era, and we start getting into the era where short editions were published on very, very high quality paper stocks with with really nice covers, we start to see a completely different type of artwork coming in. A style of artwork perhaps in a lot of books that really adds to the drama of what we're seeing. Now, that's not to say that we abandon the notion of grid-based layout and all of the things that we were talking about earlier on in terms of the timing and the drama that we can bring into a page by establishing the size and shape of those panels. But the artwork itself and the storytelling itself can really take advantage of new technologies. And I think that's something that it's about time we started doing on the web as well. We've always complained a lot about Internet Explorer 6 and some of these older browsers. And again, as I was speaking about last year, perhaps thought that we have to limit the capabilities to the lowest common denominator. But I think we can learn really now that because we have got a much richer, much more stable platform to work on, in the same way that we now have a lot more money being poured into comic book printing and a lot more quality inks and a lot more quality papers, we can really start to take advantage of that medium. And this is a book that I found. It's not a new book, but I found this when I was trawling through my kind of dusty collection of comics. And this was a comic called Blood, which is a vampire's book. It's not a particularly nice story to read, particularly just before you go to bed. But the interesting thing about this particular book is how it combines a whole bunch of different techniques inside this incredibly rich format. So we start off by thinking again about the movement, about the interpolation, and about the closure that happens as we move across individual panels. And we can see that in different ways. But when we start getting into the main body of the book, incredibly rich artwork, incredibly rich printing quality in what is an incredibly powerful story. But again, the principles, even though we've gone away perhaps from some of the traditional kind of what we think of as comic artwork, we still see the techniques and the conventions that have been established to help people move around a page. And even if it's not dialogue, even if it's sound effects graphically represented that help our eye move around these panels, those conventions are still there. Even when the artwork itself starts to very much break away from those conventions. And that's something that I think I'd like to see when it comes to the work that we now do for the web. I'd like to think that we can look back at maybe what we've done before, but also look to other mediums and think about things that we can learn, think about techniques that perhaps we can port over or adopt, and then bring those into the work that we do for the web. So, I'm going to have a hard time, unfortunately, putting these slides online at the end of the conference because obviously very little of that work was mine, but I would like to, if this is being podcast, say thank you to all those wonderful artists that put that work together. And I'd like to thank you for coming. Thank you very much. Can we have the slides back up, please? Right, now there is, I do want to do some Q&A, but I do want to have a little chat, a little fireside chat about something which I've been working on for a little while, and I'm very, very excited that I'm able to talk about today. Which, considering I've spent the last 45 minutes not talking about CSS, we can now talk about CSS a little bit. There's been, over the last several months, it's been going on for a while, but certainly over the last several months, a lot of conversations, a lot of dialogue and blog posts and criticism, I think, of the W3C, perhaps, and the CSS working group, about how bloody slow they are giving us CSS3. I mean, Bert Swan's around the world living a playboy lifestyle. He obviously doesn't do any work, and it's all his fault. And none of the people on the working group do any work at all to justify their enormous salaries. And that's why CSS takes so long. Also, you might believe if you read certain blogs. I think a lot of the criticisms that have been raised are justified. And I think a lot of the criticisms, it's a very important discussion that we need to be having now when it comes to CSS. Because let's face it, CSS 3 is taking a long time. There is no getting away from that. And the people that are on the working group are very nice people, and they're working very, very hard on what is an enormous task. So we shouldn't really criticize them for the amount of time that it takes. Particularly, one of the things that irks me is that why are we so demanding of new CSS features when potentially as designers we don't use all we've got? And we're still harking back to the fact that we can't use selectors that have been, you know, effectively supported by browsers for a very, very long time. So the specs do take a long time, but there is work going on. There is another issue, though, an issue which I find a little bit more problematic with the CSS working group. And that's because, with the exception of very few individuals, the vast majority of the people that sit on the CSS working group are the representatives of very large corporations. Multi-billion-dollar corporations that essentially provide web browsers. Now, I wonder whether or not it's right for them to decide on the tools that we should have in the next generation of CSS and the tools that we're going to use to build the next generation of websites. Is it up to them? Should they be kind of dictating these specifications? I don't think so. You know, this is our web. It's not Microsoft's or Opera's web or Mozilla's web or AOL's web or the W3C's web, for that matter. It's our web. And as web designers and developers, we ought to be deciding on the tools. And it may be up to the W3C to ratify what we want and make those a standard, and for the browser makers to implement what we want or not. And that's their commercial decision. But I don't believe it should be the other way around. And one of the problems that's happened over the last few years is that for anybody that's tried, it's incredibly difficult to communicate with anybody at the W3C for the most part and to get ideas across. I mean, even some of the great ideas that people have had seems to be the perception that they get lost in a quagmire of bureaucracy. And that's a perception which has grown up around CSS in particular. And I think it's partly justified. But I think it's about time that we stopped moaning, we stopped criticizing, and we got off our fat asses and did something about it. So, one of the things that I want to talk about today is something I've been planning for a little while, which is CSS 11. Which is not CSS version 11, but something which I'm very excited to be a part of. Which is an international group of designers and developers who are going to be committed to helping the W3C's working group to better deliver the tools that we need to design tomorrow's web. And the proposal is, and the plan is that what we're going to do, what 11 people are going to do over the next few months, is that we're going to spend 2 months working on each of the specifications that are already there in various forms for CSS 3. And we're all going to devote our time, for free, to start off with, to providing a translated version, perhaps, that real human beings can understand, but also backing those up with real graphical examples as to how we want something to work, fixing some of the things that make no sense, perhaps to designers, and maybe adding in a group of things that we need at this stage to make our lives easier and to do the kind of things that we want to do. So we're going to be working in a closed group for 2 months for each specification, and then opening that up for a month online on a wiki for anybody else to participate. And then we can give those to the CSS working group and say, here is the designer's voice, with graphical examples, with code samples that they can use as test suites, and hopefully speed the process up. And it's a bit of a put-up or shut-up point, I think, really, for both sides. If the W3C is going to stay really relevant, then we need to see some action. But if web designers and developers don't get their own house in order and just expect that these specifications are going to come down like manna from heaven, then, you know, we need to do something about it. So, who are the 11? The 11 are Australia's Cameron Adams, Gina Bolton, Mark Bolton from the UK, Dan Cederholm and myself, Jeff Croft, Mr. Aaron Gustafson, who's speaking here tomorrow, John Hicks, Roger Johansson, Richard Rutter from Clear Left in the UK, and Canada's John Snook. And we're going to really start off pretty quickly in working on the multi-column module and looking at ways in which we can really get that honed to be exactly what we need to start creating column layouts on the web. So, exciting stuff, I hope. I'm really excited that all of these people are going to start off by giving their time for free to start helping the community move this thing forward. But, as my final point, I would say, and I would ask, and this is a general kind of volunteer project point, is that why should we give up our time and our money and our effort for free when the W3C is funded by billion-dollar corporations? I think anybody that writes blog posts, anybody that participates in this kind of activity, really seriously needs to be rewarded because we're all going to benefit at some point. So I hope that there'll be sponsorship opportunities to allow these people and more, and everybody, I hope, to really make CSS3 what we would like it to really be, and quickly. So with that, I am done. I think we've got 5 minutes for Q&A, Lisa, wherever you are. We have one question on whatever it is. So with that, thank you very, very much.